The book is Praise Song for the Widow, and it is in the bookstore.
Oh.
Unpaid commercial advertisement. It's there if you want it. Highly recommend it, but we'll talk a bit more about that in a minute. Let's see. And you are?
And I am Mildred Hoffman, and I'm a former teacher and still interested in students. And there's so much being said about young people must learn how to deal with anger without being violent, and I wonder if this would pertain to that.
All right. Well, we can see if it does. Thank you. And you're?
Gary Groff-Palmer.
Welcome, Gary.
Thanks. Because I think Jesus embodies nonviolence, and the church has not taught what he taught since about 325, 330.
I'm with you on that. I wonder if you want to be in the session on nonviolence.
What is this one?
On Paula Marshall, Responses to Evil.
Evil.
Yeah.
It's at the same time, isn't it?
Yeah.
I misunderstood your question at the start. No, I want to be here.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay. That's fine. I just
Walter Wink is one of my teachers.
Uh-huh. Okay. Good. Good.
My name is Lori Miller, and I'm from Portland, Oregon. And like you, I haven't read Paula Marsh, but I've had an interest for a long time on the subject of suffering and evil perpetrated by people. And literature is something I'm very interested in, so discovering a new author.
Great.
And I would have liked to have been here for Annie Diller, but I was teaching at the same time.
Uh-huh.
Well, the one that I intended to be in, the other one for nonviolence, because I came for some of the same reasons that Mildred, but as a widow for the last year and a half, I'm intrigued. I love your book, and I think I want to stay here.
Great. Thank you. And tell me your name.
I'm Marion Barry.
Marion. Okay. Thank you.
My name is Jean, and Sarah and I came up on the boat the same day, so I had a chance to talk to her a little bit about some of what she's done in her dissertation, and so I was wanting to come to some of her sessions if I could.
Glad you're here. As I said, we'll be discussing Pauli Marshall's Praise Song for the Widow, which was published in 1984. Paula Marshall is probably one of the most under-recognized African-American women writing today. Alice Walker, you may have heard of. Toni Morrison, you may have heard of. Paula Marshall has just been writing good stories and plugging away at it for years without getting quite the recognition. There are probably a number of reasons for that. She did, however, recently receive a MacArthur grant, one of the so-called genius awards, where you get a lot of money just for being really good at what you do, to let you do more of it. She currently teaches at Virginia Commonwealth University. Couple things. One is that since we haven't read the book, it's always tricky to know how to bring you into the story. Well, I've read it and I've thought a lot about it, and I could sit here and just tell you, but what I thought I would do is give you an outline of the story and some of the themes, and then we're going to take one little episode and read it together and talk about that, because I think in that episode we'll get the major themes, and that can lead us into a discussion about responses to evil, because this really is a starting point. It's a beautiful work of art in itself, to be treasured for that. But to use it as a source of theological and ethical reflection, it becomes then a starting point to further conversation. So, if you're a teacher or a pastor who has a particular interest in using literature for theological reflection, I'd be glad to talk with you more about that. I'm not going to say very much about that practice in this class. I'd rather do it than talk about it.
You're modeling.
Well, I hope so. But we can talk about the theory some, you know, over dinner or something like that. The other thing I'm not going to say a whole lot about is evil. That is, in the abstract. One of the reasons I like to use literature is that it puts a human face on evil. And I think that's how we begin to relate to the problem and to understand it and to understand our own way of responding to evil. I think a good story allows us to enter into situations that we might not be able to do presented with them in our own lives. But given the distance of a story, we may be enabled to resonate with the character and feel our way into the situation. So it enhances our imagination. I was very struck when I heard a priest who works with Latino youth in East Los Angeles, an area of a lot of gang activity. And he said, these young people can't envision a future for themselves, and consequently, the present is not very compelling. And that thought about how important imagination is, the result is obvious. I mean, it's violence, it's drugs, it's a high suicide rate, it's crime. So that to think that imagination is so critical to our social problems, and that the stimulation that literature gives us, I hope, stimulates our imagination, use of imagination in other areas. So, I've said a little bit about Pauli Marshall. Let me say a few things more. She grew up in Brooklyn in what's referred to as the Bajan culture, that's transplanted immigrants from Barbados. So she grew up in this transplanted Caribbean culture, which had its own mores, its own way of speaking. One of the things that she likes to talk about from her youth was growing up listening to what she called the poets in the kitchen. And by that, she meant her mother and the other mothers of her neighborhood would gather in the kitchens and talk. Many of these women had to go out and work as domestics, black women working for white women. And they would come back, and one of the ways that they regained their sense of themselves, of their dignity, of having some power in the world, was sit and talk about everything. So she grew up hearing women take on the challenges of the world and think about them and try to come to some kind of resolution or understanding of them. This is her third novel, the first Brownstones, Brown Girls. Brown Girls, Brown Stones is an autobiographical novel based on her life growing up in Brooklyn. Her second novel was Chosen Place, Timeless People, about events on a Caribbean island, which is particularly good for her depiction of the interaction of white do-gooders who come to a native culture and try to tell them how things ought to be and how the culture resists that because they're not of the people. And then her third novel, Praise Song for the Widow. Okay. Praise Song. Does anybody have a sense of what that is or where it comes from?
Psalms are praise song.
That's very good. Yeah. In the African culture, very more specifically, what a praise song refers to is a chant or a poem story which dramatizes the achievements of an individual or community, both within the realm of history and within the extended family. It's usually sung by a figure within the community called a griot or a griot. They're singers. Troubadours, perhaps, might be a parallel, telling the story of the community, particularly in praise of one individual. Praise Song for the Widow, in this case, the widow is the protagonist, Avy Johnson. She's 64 years old when the story opens. Just a brief overview of what goes on in this, and I'll get into a little bit more detail in a moment, is that we see her encountering the evils of racism, gender oppression, class struggle. And we see how these evils have deformed her life and the life of her family. There's also a very strong resurrection message. And I think that in Christian terminology, we could say that this is a conversion story. Certainly, it's the story of a spiritual journey. What is of particular interest for me and why I like to use it with groups of white folks is that she brings into this, Pauli Marshall, brings into A.V. Johnson's life the black church Christianity that she knows and also African spirituality. That there's a whole different worldview, a whole different cosmology, and also way of thinking and epistemology that enter into A.V. Johnson's journey, which I think is particularly challenging for white culture in this country. Did anyone get a chance to see any of Daughters of the Dust, which is a film that we showed last night?
No. I started, but I couldn't hear very well.
It was very difficult to hear. It's difficult in any case, but there are some images in there that might help you understand the kind of culture that she's talking about. That's okay, we don't need to use that. If you do get to see that film sometime, it's called Daughters of the Dust. It's by an African-American filmmaker, Julie Dash, and I'll explain in a minute how she uses some of Paul Marshall's material in this story. That's the easiest way to explain it, I think. Praise Song for the Widow celebrates a body-centered understanding of the universe, of the self, not as an individual ego, but of a self in relation. In this world, dreams and visions, proper naming, music, sexuality, poetry, dance, are pathways between the sacred and the profane. Pathways which have to be maintained and consciously acknowledged through ritual. Its continuation requires awareness, vigilance, and strength. This sounds very mythic and sort of ahistorical. It's that, but this mythic world is parallel, exists together with a world very much grounded in history, and specifically the history of people of African descent in the New World. So she deals very directly with the heritage of slavery and the culture that emerged from that, and wants to bring back into play the valuable parts of that African culture that were lost during slavery. So let me tell you a little bit about the story. So settle in for a good story. Okay. We meet A.V. Johnson, whose full name is Avatara. We'll find out why in a few moments, aboard a Caribbean cruise ship. The cruise ship is called the Bianca Pride. Does anybody know what that translates from in Spanish?
White
Pride. And that is absolutely how A.V. has been living her life. She's at 64. She's adopted all of the mores of a white middle-class world. But something very distressing has happened. She's had a dream of her great aunt Cooney that's distressed her. And she decides that she has to leave the cruise ship. And she demands to be deposited at the next port of call with her 6 suitcases and her hat box so she can fly back to New York, which is where her home is, in White Plains, New York.
Okay. Is this a black woman?
That's right. She's a black woman. Important detail. But the only plane is left for New York. Well, what's she going to do? She has a taxi driver take her to a resort hotel. While she was on the dock trying to find a taxi, she noticed that there were hordes of people coming down onto the wharves and getting into tiny boats and setting sail. And she finds out that this is part of what's called the Carriacou excursion. Carriacou's a little island off the coast of this island where she's been deposited. And apparently the people who come from that place, from that culture, every year make this annual migration. She doesn't know what it's all about, but she just knows that they do that. She goes to this beach hotel. She feels very disoriented. This dream has really shaken her profoundly. And as she tries to unwind from the trip and figure out what she's going to do next, she falls into kind of a dream reverie where her dead husband, Jerome Johnson, appears to her on the balcony of her hotel. Now, this could be played with a lot of sort of fantasy, ghost story quality, but Paula Marshall writes this very straight. This woman has a conversation with her dead husband, Jerome Johnson. And Jerome Johnson is very angry at his wife. He says to her, "What the devil's gotten into you, woman? Do you know what you're playing around with?" He had arrived to warn A.V. Johnson that all that he had worked for, what Paul Marshall calls the whole of his transubstantiated body and blood, the insurance policies, the house, the annuities, the trusts, the bonds and bank accounts that were thrown into jeopardy by her reckless act. Because she had left the cruise ship. She had paid all this money to go on this cruise, and then because of this crazy dream, she just gets up and leaves. Avi spends most of that night in a waking dream where she starts remembering the early years of her marriage to her husband, Jerome. She remembers back when Jerome was called Jay. Jay, who worked overtime in a department store, doing two jobs, his own and his white boss's. Jay, who would come home to the sanctuary of their apartment in Brooklyn and play jazz, read poetry, recite the great Negro poets of the time. Jay, who was a lover who knew how to talk to a woman in bed. Avi remembers those moments with Jay as full of sacred mystery, very tender moments. And she also was forced to acknowledge that they got caught up in material acquisition, that Jay worked too hard, and that she worked too hard, and that they had lost touch with all of those small daily rituals that had kept them in touch with their African heritage, and also helped them remember who they were as people. Let me read you a short piece from Paul Marshall's description. I've lost it, we'll go on. Avi becomes very distressed and is forced to acknowledge that she's lost something very precious to her, and is finally able to grieve this loss, as she hadn't really grieved when her husband died, because she comes to realize that her husband had left long before he physically died, that psychically he wasn't Jay Johnson anymore. He had become someone that she didn't really know. The next morning she awakens, and she's like a young child in certain ways. Her mind is cleared, and she goes wandering off down the beach. Normally she's very careful about how she looks and how she dresses. She just puts on a simple sort of linen shift and she just wanders off down the beach. She happens to meet a man whose name is Liber Joseph. Now, Liber Joseph becomes a very important character in this novel, perhaps because he bears a very strong resemblance to a voodoo god named Papa Legba. Legba functions rather like the god Hermes in the Greek pantheon. He's the messenger. He's the one who provides connection between the spirit world and the human realm. He's in voodoo services, he's invited into the circles to kind of open the sacred space at the beginning of services. Well, that's exactly what this Liber Joseph does for Avi Johnson. He convinces her to go on the Kariakou excursion. He's leaving that afternoon. Now, Avi just wanted to go home and get back to everything that she's known, but she finds herself being swept up into this man's world, and she doesn't understand why, but she trusts, or really she gets tricked into going with him. What happens is that they get on one of these small boats that's leaving from the wharf, and they set off towards Kariakou, and she gets violently ill. She throws up. She gets violently ill, and she ends the journey in line with a sense of remembering what it was like for the slaves coming to America from Africa. It's usually referred to as the Middle Passage, and Avi has her own form of Middle Passage. It's as if suddenly she's able to tap into all of that racial memory which she had lost during those years of her marriage. And she thinks about what, she doesn't think, she feels it because her body has forced her to remember what it was like. She finally arrives in Kiriakou. Liber Joseph's daughter ministers to her, takes care of her, and the next night she goes to the big celebration there in Kiriakou. There are two parts to this. The first is called the Big Pardon, in which Liber Joseph, on behalf of the community, essentially does an act of confession, trying to atone for the misdoings of the past year. And then they have what's called the Big Drum, which are dances, in which individuals who remember their affiliations with African tribes do the tribes of that nation. Just remarkable when you think this is more than 100 years from the end of slavery, far more than maybe 150 years since their families may have arrived from Africa. During the process of the big drum, Avi is drawn into the circle of dancers, and she becomes one with them, reconnecting with her African heritage. By the time she flies back to New York the following day, she's come to realize that she has a responsibility to the next generation to help them reconnect with their African heritage. I want to say a little bit more about the dream that started all of this and about the woman, Great Aunt Cooney, who appeared in the dream. And then we'll go on and read a story that the Great Aunt Cooney used to tell her. Now, Cooney was a descendant of slaves who lived in the South Carolina Tidewater on one of the islands. And every year, Avi, as a child, was forced to go and stay with her great aunt. It turns out that she was named Avatara because when Avi's mother was pregnant with her, Great Aunt Cooney got a message from Grandmother Avatara that the grandmother had sent her spirit to be incarnated, so they named her for the grandmother. Well, believe it or not, that's what Great Aunt Cooney believed. In this dream where she appears to Avi, Avi is dreaming that she's all dressed up in her furs, ready to go to a lodge function with her husband, and her great aunt appears and beckons her to come back to this island where she had spent her summers. And Avi refuses. I mean, she's this matron now. She doesn't want to go back to this Tidewater town. They get into a fist fight, and as Paula Marshall writes it, brawling like the proverbial niggers on a Saturday night, right there in front of all the white neighbors in White Plains. Now that's just a dream. But when Avi wakes up the next morning, she feels sore all over, as if she's actually been wrestling. And that's the dream that propels her, that starts her remembering, and that propels her to leave the cruise ship. Now the story that was so important to Avi, that her great aunt used to tell her, was about a place called Ibo Landing. I think what I'll do is pass out copies of this, and then we can read it aloud to each other. My suggestion is the first time we listen to it, to the other people read, and then we can look more closely at it. I think it'll take us about 10 minutes to read this. one thing about this story is that we really need someone here who knows the Gula dialect. That's the culture of this South Carolina Tidewater area. So we'll just have to do the best we can.
There must be some significance to the Igbo, which is a Nigerian tribe.
That's right, and she's going to tell us why. What leads up to the telling of this story is an almost ritualistic process that occurred every summer, that her great aunt would gird herself with two belts and put on these thick boots and take her across the island to this place called Igbo Landing. It was about an hour's walk through the community and through the burnt out plantation down to the water's edge. And this is the story that she used to tell. Would someone like to start reading, and then when you get tired, have the next person can pick up and read for however long they'd like to? Great, thank you.
It was only a matter of minutes then before they were standing, the forest behind them and the river at their feet, on a long narrow spit of land shaped like one of Mr. Golomak's walking sticks, which marked the point where the waters in and around Tatum met up with the open sea. On the maps of the county, it was known as Igbo Landing. To people on Tatum, it was simply the landing. It was here that they brought him. They'd taken him out of the boat to right here where we standing. Nobody remembers how many of them it was, but there was a good few according to my grand, who was a little girl no bigger than you when it happened. The small boat was drawn up here, and the ship they had just come from was out in the deep water. Great big old ship with sails. And the minute those Igbos was brought on shore, they just stopped, my grand said, and taken a look around. A good long look, not saying a word, just studying the place real good, just taking their time and studying them. And they seen things that day you and me don't have the power to see, because those pure-born Africans was peoples my grand said could see in more ways than one, the kind that can tell you about things happened long before they was born and things to come long after they was dead.
Well, they seen everything that was to happen around here that day. The slavery time and the war my gran always talked about. The emancipation and everything after that, right on up to the hard times today. Those Igbos didn't miss a thing. Even seen you and me standing here talking about them. And when they got through sizing up the place real good and seen what was to come, they turned, my gran said, and looked at the white folks what brought them here. Took their time again and give them the same long, hard look. Tell you the truth, I don't know how those white folks stood it. I know I wouldn't have wanted them looking at me that way. And when they got through studying them, when they knew just from looking at them how those folks was gonna do, you know what the Igbos did? Do you? I do. It was meant for her to answer, but she always did anyway. Want me to finish telling about them? I know the story good as you, which was true. Back home, after only her first summer in Tatum, she had recounted the whole thing almost word for word to her three brothers, inflections and gestures. They just turned, my gran said, all of them. She would have ignored the interruption as usual, wouldn't even have heard it over the voice that possessed her, and walked on back down to the edge of that river, of the river here. Every last man, woman, and child. And they wasn't taking their time no more. They had seen what they had seen, and those Igbos were stepping. And they didn't bother getting back into the small boats drawn up here. Boats take too much time. They just kept walking right on up out of the river. Now, you wouldn't have thought they'd have got very far, seeing as it was water they was walking on. Besides, they had all that iron on them. Iron on the ankles and the wrists and fastened around the necks like a dog collar. Enough iron to sink an army. And chains hooking up the iron. But the chains didn't stop those Igbos none. Neither iron. The way my grand told it, other folks in Tatum said it wasn't so, and that she was crazy, but she never paid him no mind. According to her, they just kept on walking like the water was solid ground.
Left the white folks standing back here, with their mouth hung open, and they taken off down the river on foot, stepping. And when they got to where the ship was, they didn't so much as give it a look, just walked on past it. Didn't want nothing to do with that old ship. Their feet was going to take them wherever they was going that day. And they were singing by then, so my grand said. When they realized there wasn't nothing between them but home, and home but some water, and that wasn't giving them no trouble, they got so tickled they started in singing. You could hear them clear across town, according to her. They sounded like they was having such a good time, my grand declared. She just picked herself up and took off after them. Her mind, her body, she always used to say, might be in Tatum, but her mind was long gone with the heroes. She always paused here, giving the impression she was done. A moment later, though, would come a fine Lakota, spoken with an amazed, reverential laugh. Those Evos just up and walked on away not 2 minutes after they get here. How come they didn't drown in that coon? She had been 10, that old, and had been hearing the story for 4 summers straight before she had thought to ask.
Slowly, standing on the consecrated ground, her height almost matching her shadow, which the afternoon sun had drawn out over the water at their feet, her great aunt had turned and regarded her in silence for the longest time. It was to take 80 years to forget the look on the face under the field hat, the disappointment and sadness there. If she could have reached up that day and snatched her question like a fly out of the air and swallowed it whole, she would have done so. And long after she had stopped going to Tatum and the old woman was dead, she was to catch herself flinching whenever she remembered the voice with the quietly dangerous note that had finally issued, or had issued finally from under that wide hat brim. Did it say Jesus drowned when he was walking on the water in that Sunday school book your mama always sends with you? No, ma'am. I didn't think so. You got any more questions? She had shaken her head no.
Well, this is the touchstone story for the novel. What do you notice about it? What strikes you about this story?
It's become a legend, a myth.
It's made up of legend, that's right. It's still very... legend is the kind of history that continues to have a present for people. It continues to be very influential.
Like a theme of tricking the whites, or at least having a joke because they didn't need boats.
Right. Yeah. That's good. It's the underdog's picture of how you survive. Yeah, that's good.
I was struck by the part where they were singing. I realized they got away and they were just singing. Like they couldn't help themselves, I guess.
Right. Good. Good.
And also the fact that the story's been told so many times that the little girl can tell it, imitating grandmother singing. Mm-hmm. It is like a chant or a liturgy, something that's got its own form.
So many times before she ever thought to ask her.
Yeah. Right, right. So she takes it sort of as gospel. Yeah.
And she answers the question by asking another question.
Good. Yeah. Do you believe her story? Or how do you believe it? Maybe I should ask that question. That doesn't mean you have to think it's true, but Jean, you were going to say something.
I think that because it's tied with the story of Jesus, that it lends belief for me. That it was presented as being the same. Jean walking across, or Jesus walking across the water. Mm-hmm. And so, because I believe one, it makes me think about believing the other.
I believe it in the sense where she says, the grandmother said she just picked herself up and took off after her mind might be one place, but her body may be the one in one place, but her mind was the other.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of truth to that.
Uh-huh.
And certainly in terms of the space where their body might have been in one place, but their minds, hearts, and souls were not.
Right. Good point.
Yeah, I think being able to sing in chains, that truly happened, and that this is, the way I believe it is, this is a story about not being conquered and not being imprisoned, ultimately.
Rising above the chains and the water in their souls. I mean, maybe they were still shackled, but part of them got above that. And that's the part she's telling. That's what she's remembering. She's proud of that. She wants to say it over and over so that they can feel it and live it too.
That's right. Right. So that they can feel it and live it too. It has, for me, it reminds me of the Jewish Seder celebration, if you've ever participated. And I'm always struck in those celebrations that we're celebrating something that happened in the past that is happening now. Well, it's the Eucharist as well. So the irony about this story is that Avi has reversed the process. Her mind is still enslaved, and it's enslaved to white middle-class values. I think Marshall's strongly critiquing her people, that is, black people, who cling to someone else's culture and someone else's values to the detriment of their own values. Rosemary Ruther defines evil as distorted relationality, that is, relationality, distorted relationality, it affects both sides of the relationship. One of the elements that Marshall develops in this book is a different way of relating. And I want to read just a short section where Avi is coming back in touch with how it used to be for her as a little girl. She's remembering the boat trips that she used to take up the Hudson with her family. And they'd be standing on the dock waiting for the boat to arrive. You can see that boats and crossing over play a very important imagistic role in this novel, both through the middle passage and then reversing that in the trip to Kerioku. She writes, "As more people arrived to throng the area beside the river and the cool morning air warmed to greetings and talk, she would feel what seemed to be hundreds of slender threads streaming out from her navel and from the place where her heart was to enter those around her. And the threads went out not only to people she recognized from the neighborhood, but to those she didn't know as well, such as the rumors just up from the south and the small group of West Indians whose odd accent called to mind Gula talk, and who, it was said, were as passionate about their rice as her father. Then it would seem to her that she had it all wrong, and the threads didn't come from her, but from them, from everyone on the pier, including the rowdies, issuing out of their navels and hearts to stream into her as she stood there holding the bag containing the paper plates and cups, napkins, and tablecloth, which she was in charge of. She visualized the threads as being silken, like those used in the embroidery on a summer dress, and of 100 different colors. And although they were thin to the point of invisibility, they felt as strong entering her as the lifelines of woven hemp that trailed out into the water at Coney Island. If she cared to, she could dog paddle out to where the Hudson was deepest and not worry. The moment she began to founder, those on the shore would simply pull on the silken threads and haul her in." But what she discovers is that those silken threads continue across time. And this is this African cosmology I talked about earlier, is that time is a very different sense. And that the past and present aren't quite as we might define them in the West. One last thing that I wanted to point out about Paula Marshall's story about A.V. Johnson is that she gives a very particular route from bondage to liberation. A.V. reverses the story of the middle passage, that instead of moving from freedom in Africa to slavery in America, she moves from bondage to false values to liberation and the promise of the future. And the first thing that happens to start her on this journey is that she experiences alienation. And it's a good kind of alienation because her life really isn't sustaining her. It's very imprisoning to her. So the dream jolts her into a sense that she's not comfortable with the values that she's been living anymore, so she becomes alienated. That's the first step. The second step is that through the dreams and the visions that she has, she's able to recognize the source of the alienation and able to identify these false values. When she does, she's enraged. She gets very angry. And in that conversation with her dead husband, she rails against the loss that they suffered together. And then she's finally able to grieve it, because the rage has to come before the grief. It's like the Lamentations that we read in the Bible, where there's often direct, clear anger at God for something that's gone awry. And then there's the grief and request for assistance. Once she realizes her personal loss, she's able to rage and lament the community loss. So she moves from the personal to the community. And that's one of the gifts, I think, of this book, is that it's so easy for us to get lost in our own personal journey without understanding the community, the larger social component of it. So that she grieves for the loss of her marriage with her husband. And then when she goes to Kariakou, she's able to grieve the middle passage and the experience of Africans in the New World. She also undergoes a physical purging, and maybe some of you have experienced that as part of a spiritual journey as well. She next is forced to confess, to atone for the sins that she and her community have done through the ritual of the beg pardon on Kariakou. And then through the dancing, she's reconnected with her heritage. But the final step is that she pledges to herself to go back and teach others about what she's learned. And that's what makes this a praise song, because it's for future generations, that the future generations may learn. And so Paula Marshall's writing to her community.
Where's the evil? I mean, the woman's response to evil.
To evil? Well, think about the kinds of evils that A.V. encounters. There's the kind of racism. Her husband, for example, the reason he was working two jobs is that he was a black man who had gone to night school, learned to be an accountant, and couldn't get a job in a white accounting firm. He started his own firm, and even the people in his own black community didn't want to sign up for him because he couldn't possibly be as good as the white professionals. So there's that kind of racism that he encounters. There's the kind of gender oppression that A.V. experienced in her marriage with Jay, where they were never able to overcome the kind of stereotypical roles that would enable them to have the kind of communication and continue in a way that would have been sustained for them. And there's also the kind of economic deprivation that they faced living in the slums in Brooklyn and the real struggle to try to overcome that. So it's that whole heritage of slavery that she's trying to meet and respond to, both within herself and within the community. Does that answer some of your question? You still look puzzled?
Yeah, a little bit. Do you think she made some wrong choices by trying to be white? By trying to be to take on those values, that these were false values? And
she comes to the decision that they were, because that they came between her and her relationship with Jay, and her relationship with her culture and with her people. Right. Yeah. And that's the kind of distorted relationality that I sort of use as a broad definition of evil.
That's choices through awareness or not lack of awareness?
That's a good question. She didn't stop to think about what she was doing. She woke up to it decades down the road and looked back and said, this is what we could have done this differently. But to have done it differently would have meant to have remained aware about what her culture provided her. That they left behind. Yeah. And part of what her culture provided is the African American church community. I've talked about the African spirituality. Partly I emphasize that because I think that's what we're less aware of. But also woven throughout the book are her experiences with the church. She takes the boat to Kariakou. It's called the Emmanuel Sea, which gives reference to Christ. And she steps on the boat, she looks at the old black women there on the boat, and she says, they're just like the mothers of the Mount Olivet Baptist Church that I grew up with as a child. And when she gets so ill, she's just fallen asleep and she's having a dream that it's Easter morning, and that the preacher is preaching to them about when the Marys went to find Christ on the after he'd been laid in the tomb, but the stone had been rolled away, and the preacher is saying, roll away the stone of false values, roll away your indifference to other people's suffering. And that's when she experiences the physical purging. So it's both. It's both. And I think part of Paula Marshall's message to African Americans is that it's not either or, it's both, and that you have to hold both of these together.
And she could have had both. I mean, she could have had this sense of her past and a better relationship with her husband and still had a an American, upwardly mobile lifestyle.
That's a good point, because I don't think Paula Marshall is saying don't be middle class or don't live in nice places. She, the widow decides to go back to Ebo Landing, sort of as a summer place, you know, to restore it. She's going to sell her big house in White Plains, but she's not giving away all of her possessions. But she's going to use it for a different purpose, to give to other people in her community. Yeah. One question I have for you is, Jean, you mentioned that in the story of Ebo Landing, that you found it believable because of the parallel drawn with Christ walking on the water. And I wondered how other folks felt about that as Christians, whether how that strikes people, whether that's a challenge to the uniqueness of Christ, and is that disturbing?
So I don't know her agenda and her thrust of her message. But other African-American writers will use the story of Jesus or the story of the Exodus to say there are parallels here, sisters and brothers.
Uh-huh.
You know, the parallels.
Uh-huh.
Whether it's bondage and freedom, and death and resurrection.
Uh-huh. Thank you.
And that came out last night. One of the other speakers, one of the guys, was saying about how those who come to Holden, you take the boat. You have to cross over. And this season, this year, with the fires, people wondering, the fear, you know, fire. Is it safe? You know, are we safe?
Uh-huh.
We still had to take the boat and cross over.
Right.
And then we come up to this mining town. There used to be a mine up here, and we look, you know, they dug in and tried to get out the ore, you know, the good stuff, the valuable essence in the rock. And he's saying, isn't that what we're doing?
Uh-huh.
You know, we're looking in deep, trying to pull out the good stuff, the ore. So I feel a sense of that in my own.
Thank you. I hadn't thought about our passage, our middle passage up the lake. You're right. About or questions about the story or about the model it suggests to us.
I do a colleague of mine who works a lot with Native American peoples. His wife accuses him of spiritual plagiarism because he gets into their rituals and their cult and their mystical experiences, says, and he writes about it. But he also kind of idealizes it, glamorizes it in some ways. Says it's really not your experience, it's not your culture. Kind of almost like a parasite on a shark.
I've heard Native Americans be very critical of those who do precisely that, who are borrowing without being really part of the culture. They call it, some of them call it cultural genocide, and feel very strongly that it's going to help destroy them in a way that that the early conquest of land and death worked against their culture. Against
them. On the other hand, I was struck by the way that we try to somehow own, Westerhoff's term is own the faith, that, you know, somehow she's appropriating the Jesus story that she, in her own way, perhaps, and and it doesn't, you know, doesn't diminish the story in any way, either the Jesus story or this one, as far as I'm concerned. But it seems to me that one of the things that I want to be able to do is to look at the Jewish roots of my faith, the Native American spirituality, for example. Some of those things are things that I can say, yes, they're my faith too. Yes, I can identify. Yes, this can be a part of my belief system. And I don't want somebody to say to me, you know, this is bad, this is something terrible that I'm doing. And yet, in particular, the Native American belief of using the soil and God for it and only using what was needed. Some of those things I want to say, I want those to be a part of my system. I want to become aware and honor those, and they're also connected in our Jewish roots and the songs.
It sounds like what you're talking about is a appreciating and being able to use the values that underline certain practices. I think what I've heard Native Americans talk about is when particular practices are taken over without really understanding the value or the cultural values that undergird them or the cultural context they come out of. Well, I think that's a very important question to think about in our pluralistic world, is how do we honor other people's traditions and broaden our own?
Now, at the same time, I look at some people who call themselves Christians and say, I don't buy into what you believe. I am a Christian, but I do not buy into what
you
believe.
I hear you.
I think it's very difficult somehow to identify ourselves. It's, we have to kind of, I circle back to that own faith, and my faith is not yours. It's not anybody else's. I can't even pass it along to my children. I can share a certain amount of it, but ultimately it has to be theirs.
And what's, you say it's ultimately the experience has to be, the faith has to be theirs out of their experience.
Yeah, I believe that. I can pass along certain things and certain values and you can accept or reject.
And that's what Cooney tried to do with Amy, and she couldn't get it. And she heard this story all these years, and she still made these choices that drove her life in a particular way. But when she started experiencing with help from beyond, she was able to get it. It was a very embodied knowing about these values. Suddenly became much more real. I know, but you can't even provide the experiences for your children.
You really can't. You can share your ideas. You can talk about things. You can model. You can do a lot of things, but it ultimately is theirs.
It's encouraging to know that even after everybody, even if you die, like her husband died, that eventually she'll come around, kids will come around. And
oh, I mean, mine already have accepted. Mine have already accepted many of my values, and I, you know, I don't feel like I. But the value, I can't give it to them. They have to come by it themselves. They have to own it, to purchase it, hard won in terms of thought, study, experience. Whatever.
Right.
I guess I have a couple of questions to move the conversation in a little bit different direction. One is, where does your interest in evil come from?
My interest in trying to understand how to be a good person. It's not a real theoretical interest. I started out thinking about the problem of evil, the Odyssey, and I realized I could think about that a whole lot, and I still wouldn't know how to act in the world in a way that would be healing for people.
My second question is, what is it in this book that keeps drawing you back to this book that touches you so deeply?
I think the resurrection message of it on so many different levels is that she is able to awaken, even deeply embedded. It's a little too pat, maybe. That's okay. I